Good evening, all of you. I hope you're having a good week. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Appreciate your showing up for The Ghosts of Canes Part 3. And one of the things that's I've made some little changes here and there. Generally, I like to follow close to the here, but I mean, there's so much stuff that there's just no way. I mean, I'm not going to be going over every little thing, and he explains them pretty well. But as I went through the Keynesian system, you know, you come to understand that it's not really the economics per se that is attractive. Instead, I think that there is that there's two things about Keynesianism. First, it offers an easy way out. You don't have to go take the medicine. You don't have to go through the pain. Those folks just want to inflict pain on you. Those Austrians, they're the pain coughers, as Krugman calls them. They just want people to hurt. They enjoy watching people starve to death and all that. All right, so that's the one. But the other is it breaks the rules. The Keynesian system really is sort of a rule breaker. I mean, it panders to sort of atavistic notions of, you know, it goes all the way back to Bernard Mandeville in the early 1700s and his poem Fable of the Bees, in which everything was, all virtues in the economy is concerned, virtues or vices and vices or virtues. And I think it has that kind of appeal. So I'm going to be touching on some of that tonight. We've got about 30 slides to work through, and I want to work through them at a leisurely pace. But at the same time, by all means, if you have a question, please type it in, poke whatever you need to do. All right. Think about, the Keynesian system, though, first, in the general theory. Henry Hazlitt's right. You know, what's original is not true. What's true is not original. But also, Keynes himself admits that, hey, he's harking back to the era of the mercantilists. He's going back to mercantilism. And yet, what was the Wealth of Nations? It was really a book against mercantilism, and it was an attempt to attack the intellectual foundations of mercantilism, got to have lots of exports, because you want the king's treasuries to be full, you want to have colonies, and it was a system that was pretty much overthrown intellectually by people like Adam Smith, David Ricardo, and while they shunted economics down the wrong track regarding value theory, there were some other things that they did quite well. Hold on just a second. Yeah, it's not a good thing. I told people not to call while doing this class. Go ahead and turn off the heater in here. It's getting plenty warm. But I'm just told not to do that. But at any rate, going back, these were people, they had logically refuted what Keynes would bring up again. And let's understand something, that in intellectual history, ideas are recycled. They really are. That there's a lot of stuff, certainly in Christian theology, for example, the Gnostics appeared in the first century, for goodness sakes, and they've been around, and they come back, And so the you have a lot of Gnostic, you know, and then with the, what is it, the Da Vinci Code, there was a whole lot of interest in Gnosticism in the, you know, Gnostic Gospels that were written in the second and third centuries. And it's very, very interesting because, again, in, you know, the Council, you know, Chalcedon, around 435 or so, we have already refuted these errors, and so they keep popping back. And so I think that you see a lot of this going on. I mean, it's not just in economics, and certainly not just in Keynesianism. But interestingly, what was Keynes doing? Keynes is recycling the ideas of Thomas Malthus. And we know Malthus more for his population theory, and that he was, you know, that the idea was that human beings would outgrow the food supply. And so, and by the way, that was accepted. I mean, the whole doctrine of the iron law of wages came, you know, that, and the steady state, kind of a miserable state, as Ricardo pushed in his book in 1815. Some of those ideas did come back from, I got to text my wife just a second. All right, that'll keep no more calls. All right. And so what Malthus believed, you know, I think that's been refuted by experience, but also, I mean, Malthus believed that human beings, the population would grow geometrically or exponentially, while food supply would only increase arithmetically. So human beings would outgrow the food supply. But he also pushed a lot this idea that you would have a general glut of commodities because the system would overproduce generally. And not only that, people might save money. And now what's going to happen if they save? Oh, my goodness, they're not going to spend everything. And a lot of the debate, you had the famous Malthus and Ricardo letters going back and forth. I think also JBC was involved in it as well. And so you have this early on view of what they call Sayce Law, but it took hold, and it was basically almost not a tautology, but close to it, where you have to understand what is the basis of consumption, what's the basis of demand, where does our demand come from? It comes from what we produce, and that. I think that the classical said, hey, we won that argument. Now, now it's recycled again. But understand that Malthus was Keynesian long before Keynes was born. All right. And both Ricardo and Sayden, but later on John Stuart Mill again, they would, because others would raise this question, because you would have downturns every once in a while. They would blame it either on a shortage of money or overproduction or, you know, slash underconsumption. And you had others during the 19th century, Karl Marx, although his, the path of collapse is the same, but generally there's a general underconsumption. Silvio Gazzelle, whom Keynes calls a prophet, and Gazzelle advocated that people be paid in currency that would have a, you know, time limit on it before it became worthless, so they would spend it very quickly. Kind of like what happened in Vietnam at the end of the South Vietnam, then the Vietnam War, where it looked like the government was going to be overthrown, and so the paper money, the velocity of paper of South Vietnamese paper money increased greatly during that time because nobody wanted to, you know, they were still using it, but nobody wanted to be left with it. And so in order to be willing to take the risk of of selling something, you know, by you, you know, accepting that that money that people demand a lot of. Of course, prices went up very quickly. You had Sismondi, and so you had people who actually tried to dig up that thing. And other than Marx, and Marx really, it's not so much the economic theory, it's the social theory. I mean, let's face it, you know, not that many economists today call themselves Marxists. It's the English professors and the history professors and you know, the sociologists and the like, but, you know, not so much the economists. Wouldn't it, you know, even, goodness, even in the Soviet Union, I mean, you know, the most economists in the end weren't Marxists either. All right. And what happened? Okay. They saw them rejected in the late 1800s. I think I screwed up on that particular slide, but, you know, oh well. Yep, I did. But basically, let me just go back. These doctrines were rejected time and again, and they were not it was hard to resurrect it, and what would have to happen would be events themselves would sort of resurrect them, and I think we're going to be going into that. I'm one that believes that intellectual history is not simply about ideas, that there are other things that are there, and also that ideas held by progressives, that progressives believe strongly in seizing, you know, and using the power of government. And it's like with Obamacare. I mean, let's face it, Obamacare would never exist in a free market. No matter what they're saying, it would never exist in a free market. Nobody, who in the world would ever you know, buy a policy that the, you know, the prices that they're at, that why would a single man want pregnancy coverage, you know, and breast cancer coverage and all? And so the people wouldn't buy that sort of thing. It has to be forced upon them. It's like corn-based ethanol, right? I mean, how many of you would put ethanol in your cars or in your lawnmowers or anywhere else if you weren't forced to do it? You know, that you don't have a choice. And so, in other words, that and these progressive ideas generally are linked with government power, okay? And so that's, and to a certain extent, that's why we see, you know, Keynesianism still surviving. We'll get to that shortly. But these doctrines were rejected, okay? And it would take events to dig them up again, I'm afraid. Let's think about now, though, what happens in Great Britain and Europe, a little less so the United States, but especially Great Britain and Europe. Okay, understand the turn of the 20th century. Great Britain is the undisputed world leader in finance, and, you know, in manufacturing, production. The standard of living is going up. Now, it was quite low compared to, you know, what we would consider today, but it was not anything like it had been before. I mean, you know, if you could understand the abject poverty that people had lived in for centuries, and all of a sudden they see, hey, we don't have to live like this. And you had a very free economy, and Great Britain also practiced free trade. The world had a gold standard. Think of this worldwide gold standard. Every currency was matched against gold and with fixed rates. And you had, I mean, you had a system that was very, very conducive to capital formation. And, you know, and as Karl Menger would write in 1871, looking at the rise of the standard of living, he would say that Adam Smith says it's division of labor, but he says, I will tell you that it's actually the higher order goods, or what we would call capital goods, and those development of capital goods. So you see things going on, but what's happening. I mean, it's again, it goes back to what we sang in that opera, you know, great minds against themselves conspire and shun the truth and shun the cure they most desire. And you look at these folks, what did they do? Well, they used their technology to build, you know, mass destruction weapons. And then they also, you know, they have bigger populations now, bigger populations, larger armies. And the governments themselves were not all that strong relative to what we have now. I mean, those got all, even the, except for the Bolsheviks, I'm talking about even the worst of the bunch would not have been anything like you see today. I'm going to get some water right across the hall just for a second because my throat's getting scratched. Oh, I apologize for this. All right, feel better. Okay, now you think about this. Okay, 1914, World War One breaks out. Now understand that everybody thought, hey, this will be over in 6 weeks, just like the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. Not going to be any big deal. All right, and what happens? You have trench warfare. You've got stalemate. You literally had trenches dug all the way from the English Channel all the way down to the Swiss border in Western Europe. Eastern Europe, you've got, casualties. And we're talking about just mass casualties. That the world had never seen anything like this. The worst carnage before on a large scale had been the American Civil War. But This was something quite, quite unique. And you know, they start calling it the war to end all wars. But in fact, World War One was the first war ever fought in which more people died from being killed in battle than died of disease. It used to be disease that would, you know, would affect everybody. But 1914, 1918, literally so much of what was built up in that previous century in Europe is destroyed. How do you fund a war? Okay, well, you don't pay as you go, do you? Not a total war. Not the kind of war that was being fought with just millions of men being sent into the trenches and backup positions. And so it's you just literally empty your labor force practically. And you send them to the front. And think of the losses that are occurring. And by the way, there was now World War One had some, you know, the civilian. Obviously, there was a lot wrong in, you know, the civilian casualties too. And there were cities that were damaged, towns that were smaller towns that were destroyed. But the property damage of World War One, as bad as it was, is nothing like what you see in World War II, because World War II, now we have mass bombings and, you know, carpet bombing of cities and ultimately the atomic bomb. But the weapons, the ground weapons of World War One, were pretty awful. That's trench warfare. You come out of the trenches, somebody, you know, on the other side, they have machine guns, they mow people down. And then you would have a counterattack. They'd get mowed down, and so on and so forth. And this was how, this was how this war was fought. And people just went back and forth. And so you have to understand what this is going to do, or what this did to Great Britain and Europe. I mean, it's destruction on a wide scale, loss of life on a wide scale. This is a cataclysmic event. And not only that, but all of the liberalism that had developed up until then. Think about this. You went from country to country. You didn't have to have passports. That you think about all of the government hoops you have to go through just to go and travel anywhere overseas. That didn't exist back then. You just had to have a way to get there. And people were freer. Speech was freer, much, you know, more so then. And people protected their liberties, not just the United States, but in other countries as well. Now, in the United States, you had the progressive movement, which I've written a lot about it. And I will tell you, I do not have a very high opinion of American progressives. And it really goes in the late 1800s and then also into the 1900s, culminating really in 1913 when you've got passage of the Federal Reserve Act, direct election of senators, the income tax. Oh, joy. I mean, does it get any better than this? And so you had the but even then, you know, Americans were much more vigilant about protecting their liberties than they are now. But what happens? By the way, when the United States goes into World War One, the Espionage Act of 1917 is passed. That's what the Obama administration trotted out against Bradley Manning. And they want to try Julian Assange on that. You know, 1917 law, and you have the Trading with the Enemy Act that Roosevelt will use in 1933 to seize America's gold. So you had a real, there was one man imprisoned who was a filmmaker in prison because he did a movie on the revolution, American Revolution, and, you know, apparently didn't make the British look good at all. And so he goes to jail for it. And Americans were willing to accept that, I guess. I mean, it's just, you know, this total war mentality. Also, during the war, you have the organization of industry, because it's such a large scale. It's how do we get this stuff coordinated? And so you have these trade associations in the United States. You had essentially cartelization, government sponsored cartelization. You had all of these entities that, by the way, would later be reborn in the New Deal, all right? And so, in other words, the New Deal did have a lot of groundwork, you know, laid before it. And so in Great Britain, you have this same kind of movement as well, you know. But the war itself, just people give up their liberties. The gold standard is just absolutely smashed because countries resort to inflation. The French, literally French central bank, just cranked out notes to pay, you know, accepted French bonds and monetized them. And so you can imagine the kind of inflation they had in France. And so all of this stuff goes out the window. Not only that, look, 1917, Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And so now we have murderous totalitarian regimes. I mean, we're talking about this, the summary executions of millions of people. And I mean, the horror of it. And ultimately, and you know, this is, and so you go from, think about this, from liberal era, pre-liberal era where people protected their liberties, you have this cataclysmic war. In the aftermath, Central Europe, you've got communists and right-wingers fighting in the streets. I mean, it's literally street warfare that's going to determine who governs. You've got the Bolshevik Revolution. You have later on hyperinflation in Germany. I mean, so you think about the breakup of empires into new states. The Austria-Hungary Empire is now just totally broken up. And so if you think about this, what it's going to do, think of as a young person, okay? You've been told something all your life about your country and about hard work and everything, and then all of a sudden you're forced to participate in a war. Let's say you survive the Battle of Verdun. which is, or the battle in the zone. And you see the utter inhumanity of it all. Think about how you come out of that. Right? Think about how your worldview is going to change. And so, you know, I'm saying again, the general theory would have gone nowhere had it been written in the 1880s, 1890s, even in 1900, early 1900s. It just would have gone nowhere. But now you've got cataclysmic events, by the way, that are government-sponsored, aren't they? This isn't capitalism. This isn't free enterprise. This is government. Now it's government corralling the capitalists. It's the capitalists that make the weapons of war and do it for profit. But nonetheless, the capitalists did not start the war. It was, you know, it was government. If you look at that, a couple pictures here of Verdun. I mean, this is what people saw every day. You lived with this every day. Very few people would have survived 4 years of it. I mean, you think about being holed up in these trenches, and all of a sudden the whistle blows, and you're to come out of there. And it's really, really bad. And some of the reading I've got, years ago, and about 10 years ago, Lou Rockwell's page, I had a couple of poems by Siegfried Sassoon. And very, very, one of them is very descriptive, called Counterattack. So it's very descriptive of what it was like in the trenches and the fighting. And you get the sense, you know, in fact, his poetry was banned, you know, during the war, his writings were banned. But you read that, and the cynicism, about the person, you know, losing his leg, or, you know, losing his sight, or whatever. And you know, that poem's in there too. And talking about Luke from warfare. And by the way, there are some pictures I could have posted that are just utterly graphic, like one dead Frenchman who was killed by mustard gas, and see what that was like. And so, I mean, you're talking about some real horrors there, and the effect that it's going to have, and what it does is it really ripens the ground, not only for an economic collapse, which we will see, but also it ripens that ground for somebody just like John Maynard Keynes to step in. All right. And, you know, we've talked about this. London was the financial capital of the world before 1914. Afterwards, it's Wall Street in New York City. And remember, America is less touched than anybody else in this war. We lost, I think, 117 people. One of them, my great uncle, Ralph Cowell, who was killed in the last month of the war. And so I never knew him. I knew his sister, because his sister was my grandmother, but knew her well. But, you know, he said, I mean, people, you know, about 117,000 isn't going to touch everybody, not like what you saw in Germany and Great Britain. But you think of the effects, all this money printing, all of this wartime stuff that it has on Great Britain. And France and Germany and all, and, you know, so the gold standard's gone. Okay. Now what happens? Okay. Well, the land of hope and glory. I mean, this is the land that gives us Rudyard Kipling and Edward Elgar the Pomp and Circumstance, which is sung to, you know, land of hope and glory. Sorry, can't answer. But at any rate, after the war, what has happened? Britain still wants to cling to its colonies. Its colonies, you know, I mean, politically, that's much more difficult to do. But you've got, you know, again, the country that produces Rudyard Kipling now has Siegfried Sassoon. And it's a different shift in thinking. That people are more cynical. The Great Britain of the late, of the early years of Winston Churchill no longer exists, thanks to this war. And afterwards, though, hold on just a second. Okay. Hello. I am teaching a class right online right now. So you're on camera. I'm on camera. I've got people all over the place. So I can't call. But I appreciate your call. At least, yeah. Yeah. Okay, you take care. But following the war, what happened? Great Britain, it's still this, we're going to go back to usual. So they want to prop up the pound sterling, $4.86, to 1 pound. And I couldn't reproduce a little, whatever that thing, the symbol for the pound. But so what you have is an overvalued pound, which contributes to high unemployment. During the 1920s, you've got, high rate of unemployment. So you think about this. You fight this war, come back, and now you can't get a job. And you're going to start having the growth of the union, aren't you? You're going to have more labor and education because long persistent unemployment is going to do that. People have to make a living. How do you do it? And you also have the world economy damaged. So you've gotten Great Britain depended so heavily on exports. I mean, it had, it actually ran trade deficits all during its golden years, partly because it was such a haven for capital. But that's gone. All right. And so, again, think of, I want you to think of the aftermath. When I was in graduate school, professors generally seemed to believe that none of the things I'm talking about would have any effect on economics. Economics is about pure supply, demand, dollars and cents. It's about interest group, what's in my interest right now, and that ideology has nothing to do with anything. And intellectual climate has nothing to do with anything. I remember George Stigler saying that, Milton Friedman was wrong. Milton Friedman had said that Hong Kong had free trade, but when it was being developed as a British colony in the early stages, that's the way, that's where the intellectuals were. That's what was taught in school. By the time India achieved independence, socialism was all the rage by then. And so, I don't know how true that is, but see, Stigler said, oh, that has nothing to do with anything. Well, I think that, certainly the intellectual climate does affect what people are willing to accept. Today it's in America, it's statism. I mean, let's think about this. Would something like global warming have been able to get off the ground 50 years ago? No. For that matter, my senior year in college, Newsweek had a big story, cover story, that we were headed for an ice age. All the same things, burning coal and fuel, fossil fuels, going to cause us to get real cold. Now it's going to cause us to get real hot. So, what we're dealing with, of course, is, political theories. And so, I think that the tenor of the times does matter. You look okay now, but here's something else. Socialism had been there. Socialists didn't go away. I mean, socialists had been around. And so the socialists now have some ground. It's like Hitler. Hitler in the early 20s was seen kind of, he was a clown. right? And all of a sudden, 1932, they take power. Why? Because Germany is in a Great Depression, and Germany was hit harder than any country in the world. And so you had the Bolsheviks being successful, and it attracted both British and American writers. And I would urge you to read, all of a sudden I can't think of the name. It's by Paul Hollander, Political Pilgrims, a book that I read 30 years ago, Political Pilgrims. And if you read about the American, British, and French intellectuals visiting the Soviet Union, you don't make me sad. I mean, you think, how could these people who are so smart have fooled themselves? Well, it happens. It happens all the time, Bill. Believe me. It does. And so you look at what these folks did. They wrote so favorably. Oh, Russia, I mean, the Webs had a volume, Soviet Russia, Soviet Communist, a new civilization. They were going, oh, this was going to be a grand and beautiful civilization. My. All right. So what happens? Well, now we have the Great Depression, and the critics are saying, yep, this proves it once and for all. Capitalism is a failure. Look, it's like Michael Moore's movie, Capitalism, A Love Story. It would have gotten it really wouldn't have had any traction in the mid to late 90s, or certainly in the mid to late 1980s, when, especially the 80s, you've got entrepreneurs doing, there was a real burst of entrepreneurship in America. But after the meltdown of 2008, all of a sudden, Michael Moore has an audience. And so people look at this, the unemployment, maybe we should have maybe we should have a centrally planned economy. I mean, do we really want all this lurching back and forth between boom and bust? And so people believe, well, we can have a planned economy. We can plan our way out of that. And these ideas are taking hold. I went into in Rothbard's book. I really would urge you to read. It's called Pains of Man. It's only about 68 pages, so it's not a real, not a long piece of work by any means. But I want you to read what Rothbard wrote, because I think that Rothbard understood that about the intellectual climate at that time. This is, part of the reason Schumpeter's pointed out, governments as well as the intellectual climate of the 1930s were ripe for such conversion. All right, conversion from what? From the sort of the doctrines of liberalism, all right, of anti-statism, of free markets, free prices, movement of capital and capital formation and the like. And now, all of a sudden, people are saying, boy, that didn't do us any good, did it? He says, governments are always seeking new sources of revenue and new ways to spend money. And look, they see all the need there, so people want the government to do something, right? Often with no little desperation. Yet economic science for over a century had sourly warned against inflation and deficit spending, even in times of recession. That's right. And economists, whom Keynes was to lump into one category and sneeringly disparage as classical in the general theory, were the grouches at the picnic, throwing a damper of gloom over attempts by government to increase their spending. Now came along Keynes with modern scientific economics, saying the old classical economists had it all wrong. And on the contrary, and this is, what he's saying, Keynes is saying, it was the government's moral and scientific duty to spend spend and incur deficit upon deficit in order to save the economy from such vices as thrift and balanced budgets and unfettered capitalism, and to generate recovery from the depression. How welcome change in economics was to the governments of the world. And by the way, remember early in the first session we had that Krugman quote about why Keynesianism took hold. I mean, it's interesting. Rothbard and Krugman are they're on opposite sides, and yet they're saying the same thing. In addition, the one difference is Krugman actually believes it, whereas Rothbard knows it's a crock. All right, in addition, intellectuals throughout the world were becoming convinced that laissez-faire capitalism could not work, and it was responsible for the Great Depression. Communism, fascism, and various forms of socialism and controlled economy became popular for that reason during the 1930s. Keynesianism was perfectly suited to this intellectual climate. And I really believe that too. You know, George Stigler would disagree. Most of the old Chicagoites. But I think Rothbard is right here, that ideas do need fertile ground. The ground indeed was fertile for somebody to come along and say, hey, I've got an answer for you. And Rothbard adds, okay, this is, as a prominent Cambridge economist, remember this, that he was, Keynes was one of Alfred Marshall's students. And in Great Britain, especially around the early 20th century, and that all of the major economic posts in terms of in the universities in England, and I think maybe not probably Great Britain, well, were held by Marshall students. I mean that, and England was, even though the marginalism had already developed, and I think Menger's thinking really was most sound of all the environment of the marginalists. England, we looked to England for scholarship. I mean, its universities were the finest in the world. England had that reputation. It was a place that you looked to. And Alfred Marshall was probably at that time the most influential economist in the world. And now Marshall, believe me, was not Keynes, and a very, very different kind of person, very moral, whereas Keynes was not. And, but, you know, believed in thrift and all these other things, right? As a prominent Cambridge economist and student of Marshall, Keynes had an important advantage in furthering the success of the ideas in general theory. It's safe to say if Keynes had been an obscure economics teacher at a small Midwestern college, American college, his work in the unlikely event that even found a publisher would have been totally ignored. In those days before World War II, Britain, not the United States, was the most prestigious world center for economic thought. While Austrian economists had flourished in the United States before World War I, in the works of David Green, Frank Fetter, and Herb Davenport, the 1920s and early 1930s was largely a barren period for economic theory. Anti-theoretical institutionalists, students of Thorstein Veblen, dominated American economics during this period, leaving a vacuum that was easy for Keynes to fill. So again, you've got certain things that are happening, I think, intellectually, that would be, I think, intellectually, it's a, I think, again, there are times when the ground is fertile and when the ground is hard. And at this time, the ground is fertile. Just by the way, just as, and I'm not saying Ronald Reagan was the apostle of free enterprise, but he ran a campaign in 1980 on free markets, relative free markets. They even talk about Say's Law in the 1980 campaign. Could you imagine that going on today? George W. Bush or, Say's Law. I said, oh, did I break that one too? You know, think about the last two elections. I mean, you didn't have anybody who Barack Obama, he wouldn't know anything about that. So understand again that, you know, that even politically, you can discuss things. Do you think JFK would have run on a platform of global warming in 1960? He'd have been laughed off the platform. All right. And that's part of the discussion. Okay. What I want to do, okay. So, in other words, I'm laying out the intellectual climate. Why? Because Keynes is the kind of person that will appeal to the sarcasm and to the cynicism of that particular age, all right? Because Keynes is a pretty sarcastic and cynical person himself. He's also part of that intellectual elite. And, Keynes understood that, by the way. I mean, Keynes really understood that he was part of that 1%. And he reveled in that position, but he understood the limitations as well. But we have to, but at this point, Bo, I want to ask you, see if any of you have any questions before we're going to switch gears and actually get more into the economics of Keynesianism. But I want to switch gears just a little bit and see if any of you have anything to ask. All right. I don't see anything. Let me make sure I'm down in chat and click Q&A. Nope, nothing there. All right, so I'm going to assume for the time being that there are no questions. If you have comments, though, again, please, please, please. Hey, thanks. Cam, hey, I appreciate that. I really do appreciate that putting political pilgrims up there. All right. Okay. So let's look at it. Was Keynes wrong? Of course, we believe he is. I don't know, maybe some people sign up for this course who are ardent Keynesians who just want to spy on me, but I don't think it's going to be $59 to do it. I believe that all of you who've signed up believe Keynes was wrong. All right. But you'd like a little more intellectual ammunition, wouldn't you? And you'd like to be able to take another look at this. It's not that you're all of a sudden going to convert to Keynesianism, but you would like to be able to understand the arguments. I like to be able to understand and to really to better be able to position myself. Because once in a while, people are going to ask these things, about, all right. Austrians, what we believe is that Keynes is a clever writer. Going back to Henry Hazlitt, there's nothing that's true and original. And his economics are just awful. So that's where we stand right now. All right. And now what I'm going to do is go through some of the things that Hunter Lewis did. I mean, I went through the book. I can't do everything in there. We would be here for several hours. And I am assuming that all of you either have a book or are interested in that you can read. And that, and it's not difficult reading, so I think you would probably be willing to do that. But something Lewis points out when he deals with interest rates. Now, by the way, he says interest is the price of money. Not really. Interest is the payment that, it's a time preference. The Austrians believe in a pure time preference view of interest. Excuse me a second, I'm going to get a little more water. All right. But nonetheless, if you think about it, what do we need as an entrepreneur? Entrepreneurs are going to have have accurate sets of prices. That is, prices determined in the market, not Obamacare prices as determined by the government. We're talking about real life prices, okay? And they're going to send signals, and interest rates also send signals. What is it, the information that the interest rate conveys? Interest rate should convey time preferences of individuals in the economy. And do people, are they saving more? That means that they want to consume more in the future. That means that they would like to, and so doing, their saving allows entrepreneurs to develop capital and to really, and over time, to deepen that capital. That is, make it more complex and make it, to make even higher quality goods. And this intertemporal, like over time, it tells you, you know, people who have a lot of hope for the future are going to save more, right? And so you're going to be looking at future expectations, present realities, and you have a set of prices, don't you? You have sets of prices that you can make judgments about, right? So you need market rates. And if you remember Keynes, the central thing in Keynes is that the rent's too high. The interest rate's just too high. And I remember there was some guy running in New York City for mayor, and I think his platform was the rent's too high. And the government in Venezuela now declaring their profits and prices are too high, so they're going to lower them, and they basically had people loot the electronics store. And so now, I'm sure that they're not going to worry too much about empty shelves, at least for now, because the election's coming up after the blame on the capitalists. But we know what's going. The thing is, we know what's going to happen in Venezuela, because the government there said prices are should not be allowed to tell the truth. We're going to tell our own truth. Well, what did Keynes argue? He argues that capital is artificially scarce, that if we could get interest rates to zero, and not only that, if government really were in control of capital development, because government agents tend to be much more long-term focused than do individuals in capitalists. And we'll go over some of the other things he said. But his idea was private owners of capital and the banks were selfishly withholding capital, that we could have more. What Keynes is really saying is, look, do what I say, and we won't live like we did under capitalism. We'll live even better. We're going to make this economy more productive. We're not producing enough stuff. It reminds me of around 1982, you start having some real headway in high-tech industry in the United States. And so a number of Democrats decide that, hey, we need to help it along. We need to have Japanese policies like MIDI, so we need a central planner. And we need to target, the market can't do this, market's too short term. We need to target industries and then funnel resources to them. And they were called the Atari Democrats. And guys like, I think, Bill Bradley, and John Kerry, and some others. It was, the idea was that the last thing they wanted was capitalism. They wanted to help the capitalists along. So what would happen if government got a hold of that process? Why, government could produce or pay for unlimited amounts of capital. And that's what he calls the euthanasia of the rentier. All right, where, in other words, the capitalists, we're going to change the structure of things, you see, drive interest rates to zero, so we're always going to have easy money, We're going to make capital development a priority. We're going to have more capital than you can imagine. And it's going to result in a higher standard of living than you could ever imagine. And all it takes, and it's easy, all it takes is the government to take over the process. That's all. All right. Interest, good question, Mike. Let me talk about this for a second here, because interest is what we pay to have resources now as opposed to later. On the borrowing side, that's what you're doing, okay? You want to buy a car, and it says, let's say the car is $10,000, okay? Well, you can try to get $10,000 in cash, and if you have it, you may pay for it. You may pay cash for your car. But if you don't have it, or you don't want to spend it like that, you say, okay, I will borrow the money, and then I will have enough. Then I will purchase the car, and then I'll make payments over time. All right. Well, what's going on? Okay. You wanted to be able to control resources now. Okay. So you're paying interest. And interest should reflect the time preferences of individuals. Okay. Now, what about the saving side? Okay. You save money, and you are paid interest with the idea that over time, the interest will allow that amount of money to grow, and you'll be able to consume more. But that's also a time preference, right? That you're willing to save, okay, you're willing to wait for the future before, you're willing to curtail some of your consumption now so you can save and then consume more in the future. So really, interest is not the price of money. Interest is what you pay in order to control resources now. I would urge you to go into the Mises literature list. And Rothbard has the thing, the pure time preference view of money, of interest, I mean, time preference theory of interest. And so I really would recommend you doing that. And I mean, I can understand, people have tried to define rent as being, a payment, like, I'm not rent, I mean, interest is like rent for money. In fact, interestingly, John Calvin used that, the Catholic Church back in the Middle Ages, in fact, said that you couldn't pay interest, or you couldn't charge interest, so they called it usury. And that, and it went back, it wasn't really from biblical arguments, but rather from the Greeks, from Aristotle, who believed that money was sterile, and so the interest violated natural law. And so Calvin wrote, well, hey, I have an apartment, I own a house, and I rent the house to somebody. He said, isn't rent kind of like that? And isn't interest like that? So he likened it to paying rent, but that's, that's not a, it's not a good definition, but nonetheless, you can see where he's going with it. All right. But his point was that if the state could get a hold of that process, of the capitalization process, and where the capitalists go, where they invest in capital, the state would do it, it would do a better job. And what about the investors? Oh, all right. Now, Keynes, as you know, did very, very well for himself. Became very wealthy as an investor. I think he lost it all, but got it all back. But Keynes, as Rothbard points out, had more respect for them than did savers and consumers who were robotic. He had this mathematical marginal propensity to consume. The capital owners, they were just hopeless. But here's the problem: investors are guided by animal spirits and easily led down wrong paths. right? And this was a real problem, okay? And this is the reason state agents need to get a hold of this, because the what would happen, the animal spirits would lead to big fluctuations in spending, all right? Because you've got lots of capital spending 1 year and not so much, and there's a multiplier effect. He argued that there was this, and that's where the Keynesian multiplier comes from. And if you notice, by the way, the Keynesian multiplier, it's 1 over the savings rate. And so the less you save, the greater the multiplier. And all the way, but if you save zero, he said somehow that would create inflation, you know, hyperinflation. So you have to save something in order to, you know, maybe a penny a year or something like that in order to keep hyperinflation from occurring. But, you see, he looked and said, look, why do we have these business cycles? Well, it's investment spending. And these guys are guided by animal spirits. They're not guided by crisis so much. It's animal spirits. And we've got to have government agents who can rise above that. So, again, you can start seeing, you can really see where the state is in the place. All right. Well, where does this stand? Okay, I mean, let's think about this for a second. I mean, how do we refute it? Okay. Well, what does Hazlitt say about it? Well, it says investment's a key decision in the operation of any economic system. The government investment is a form of socialism. All right, only confusion of thought or deliberate duplicity would deny this. For socialism, as any dictionary would tell the Keynesians, means the ownership and control of the means of production by the government. Under the system proposed by Keynes, the government would control all investment in the means of production and would own the part it had itself directly invested. Okay, and so there's a mere muddle-headedness, and therefore to present the Keynesian notion as a free enterprise or individualistic alternative to socialism. In other words, people were saying, well, Keynes is just trying to save capitalism from itself. You know, that's what George Bush said, wasn't it? You know, we had to basically, it's like what General Westmoreland said about Vietnam, we had to destroy in order to save it. Well, you know, Bush, well, we have to destroy capitalism in order to save it. And but understand what he's saying. All right, he's making the assumption that government agents are far more, and by the way, it would be bureaucrats and people, or people like him, intelligent people, people who really were above the average investor, the average mass of people, whatever. And so that, you know, yeah, he thought of himself as, well, we're better than this. That, and so these are the folks that would determine investment. Now, by the way, have we seen this before? Yeah, we have seen this before. It's called the Soviet Union. All right? It's called China before they decided to stop being Maoville. And what you find is capital directed towards whatever. But the thing about, to keep in mind, and this is something that I've written about a lot, under these socialistic systems, capital becomes a liability, not an asset. I think you've heard me say this before, but I'm going to repeat it. What happens? Capital can earn an income, as it were, okay, income for its owners. And so therefore, the profitability, whether or not you should invest in capital, becomes tied up with what's going to happen. What kind of income can I earn from this? And as long as you can earn income, then the capital to you is an asset. But what if capital does not earn an income? All right, what if capital instead is paid for out of appropriations? Well, I will give you Federal Aviation Administration. And I don't know what their system is. They've modernized it all now, but for years, the FAA was operating with vacuum tubes and other, you know, 1920s technology in the 1980s and 90s. And there was a lot of push, man, we got to modernize the system. But you have to remember that government was in charge of the capital stake, and there wasn't a profit to be earned from that. It didn't matter to the people making the decisions regarding the FAA and what it should, what kind of equipment it should have, because they were not going to be earning an income from it. They would get more kudos from diverting the money from the from buying equipment for the FAA and pushing it into, you know, expanding, you know, the welfare system, like in medical care, or something like that, or giving a grant to a hospital, something of that matter. But nonetheless, the point being that in a socialistic system, and by the way, in the system that Keynes was promoting, capital would become a liability, not an asset. One of the things that happens, by the way, Canadian medicine, that Canadian medicine, you know, you talk about having to wait in line for certain kinds of you know, tests and like, you know, I had a week from Thursday, I'm going to have knee surgery. And for week five, you'll see me, you know, I'm have my knees, you know, stretched out somehow. I don't know exactly how I'll do it, but and I'll be in a good mood because I'll have no painkillers. But nonetheless, I had an MRI, and the doctor said, "Hey, you're going to need an MRI." And so in a few days, I'm over there getting, you know, the knee. I've been in Canada, it would have taken me months and months and months and months. Okay, with my knee going like this. Now, why? Because why buy another MRI when you can use the money to give raises to the nervous system, the doctor? Because they may go on strike if they don't get raises. But, you know, why buy an MRI? We're not going to make an income from it. It's, you know, it's a lot. It becomes a liability. And and Keynes, for all his cleverness, could not have gotten around that. And I think that's one of, you know, now that's something that really has not been developed in anti-Keynesian stuff, but nonetheless, right? Hey, I'll tell you what, Cam, you are on top of it. There's a question about, yeah, government spending slowed, you know, down the private sector. Yeah, it's government spending creating a negative multiplier. I like that. You know, it's Mike Higginbotham, and I think he's right. I think we do have a negative multiplier. It implodes. These things implode in on themselves, and so kudos for that. I like it. And again, though, think what I said about capital, and you start looking at socialistic capital and things that, and by the way, those capital intensive industries where government is making the choices, and you think about, I mean, you know, why do bridges collapse? All right. And, you know, far be it, you know, why would a government, you know, airline, like, for example, you know, the Russian airline, you know, Aeroflot, back in the days of communism, they used to call it Scareflot or Aeroflop. All right. It was now granted there are some state run airlines that are pretty good. And Mises pointed that out himself. Mises said, look, you can, like, you know, you go to the Moscow subway back in the days of communism. It was grand, beautiful chandeliers. He said, you can put lots of resources here, but we live in a world of scarcity, which means these other resources cannot be put elsewhere. All right. What about inflation? This is another interesting point because Keynes, you know, we know what he wrote in The Economic Consequences of the Peace about inflation. You know, he was right. I thought it was very good. But was Keynes an inflationist? Heck yes. Of course he was. Because what did he argue for in general? And you can read it there. I mean, he's absolutely clear that, you know, for all of the talk these guys have about you can't cut wages because then that'll drive the system downward. But somehow he wants to come in the back door, right? We're going to cut wages with inflation. Because as Keynes writes, the worker's only interested in his money wage, which would be a nominal wage. All right. So the idea is to have inflation come in and cut the real wages of workers. And I had in 1991, I was teaching, it might have been 92, but I was teaching an upper division macro class at University of Tennessee Chattanooga. And they used Wallace Peterson's text. And Peterson's text was easy to read, but he quoted things like scripture, right? And so what Peterson argued was that cutting wages via inflation was more humane than actually cutting them, right? But here's the problem. Again, we talked about before this a view of resources and factors being homogeneous. Look, at any given time in markets, some wages are higher than they should be, but some are also lower. All right. In other words, that things have gotten out of whack, not because everybody's being paid too much, but maybe some people are relative to what they're producing, other people are not. Okay. In other words, or there's other industries where they could go where their productivity is needed. And so you look at, in other words, we're looking at relative prices. Well, the idea here is that, hey, everybody gets a wage cut. Okay. By the, you know, same percentage. It's this, MV is equal to PY equation in which, you know, everything's homogeneous. You just cut the real wages, but everybody gets the same cut. Well, it doesn't work that way, people. Because, I mean, as we know, inflation does, in fact, transfer resources, does it not? And so what are the real effects, okay? Look, if you think about it, money's neutral, although it really can't be, because if you're cutting real wages, you're having some effect. Well, I mean, neutral is that he doesn't see it as what really happens, is that it changes the relative value of real resources or real resources relative to each other. All right. And and Roger Garrison, I never had him for class, but we had seminars and stuff. And Roger made this point time and again that they're assuming homogeneous capital, And also in the inflation, what does it do? It disrupts the relative price relationships between real assets. In other words, their relation to each other. And that's one of the things. What happens is, you know, you have it, but and now all of a sudden it's more advantageous to go down this road. You go down a road that you would not have gone down had there been no inflation. Right? And ultimately that is unsustainable. Because inflation, I mean, you know, you have rounds of it. And each round that you have is not as effective as before. Let's think about this for a second, guys, what I'm saying. Do you remember the late 1990s when the economy was absolutely booming? You know, that Paul Vogel in his book about the Clinton administration wrote, you know, the best economy ever. Okay. We had 2%, you know, unemployment some places. The stock market was going wild. People were getting rich. It was 1929. You had what triggered it? Well, easy money policies from the Fed. And then we had the crash, and then we have the recession. And then coming back, the Bush administration with Alan Greenspan and later Ben Bernanke, what they want, okay, easy money policies. And so finally, easy money policies give us, they get triggered into the housing market and also into refinance, in the refinance market for mortgages. And we had another boom, did we not? Now understand, remember the rate of unemployment was higher at the height of that boom than it had been at the height of the previous one. In other words, you had the effects, you had a boom, but it was not as big as before. And so what's happened? Okay, they've tried it again, easy money policies. And believe it or not, we're actually in the middle of a boom. Yeah. We're in the middle of a boom. Sure as heck doesn't feel like it, does it? This is a boom, though. This is a, you know, which is, makes me really nervous. You know, I look at the stock market, wow, now 1600, why? And, but, you know, it makes me nervous because I'm thinking, okay, what's around the corner? You know, are we looking at Armageddon? But nonetheless, you can see the point, though, that inflation is going to have a very pernicious effect. And Keynes just doesn't recognize it. Why? Because he was looking, it's a great level. Right? I mean, Paul Krugman goes even further. He says, you know, if you're against inflation, you want people to suffer. You want people to be out of work and, you know, and to have a living hell on earth. Amazing. Right? Keynes, who, by the way, is a saver himself, but he has pure contempt for saving. Oh, predatory savers. Oh, my God. And he mocks the views. Okay. He said that this doctrine of saving, there's other stuff I ran into. I just didn't have enough time to, you know, to put it all down. But conquered England as completely as the Holy Inquisition conquered Spain. Oh, my gosh. I mean, we're talking the Inquisition here, you know, and, if any of you have ever seen My Fair Lady, if you remember Henry Higgins singing about I'll Never Let a Woman in My Life, and he says, I prefer a new edition of the Spanish Inquisition than to ever let a woman in my life. And you know, of course, we have the, at least the modern view of the Inquisition is not being very, you know, a very happy time. It was actually 1492 when the Inquisition began. That we see it, you know, Columbus coming to America, but also the that's the year that they kicked the Jews out of Spain, and I'm wondering, I'm not sure that they've ever really recovered from that, but nonetheless, that here you think, you know, what sarcasm? Yeah, conquered England as completely as the Holy Inquisition conquered Spain. And so this war, what a terrible thing, it conquered England. What conquered it? Oh, a view that an economy grows and people become wealthier overall by investing in more capital. And where does investment come? It comes from savers. And so if you save, you earn interest, you are able to invest in capital production, and then you will reap later on interest, and you will be able to consume the goods that are being made or will be made in the future through this capital development. And this is seen as some sort of, you know, terror, holy terror or something. I mean, you gotta, you know, it's the kind of sarcasm, okay, that really appeals to, you know, the Bloomsbury set people, you know, the intellects. And then there's the cake. Oh, yeah, Keynes basically writes that saving through generation is just futility. Why? It's just like you're baking a cake, and it's getting bigger and bigger, but you never eat the cake. No. It's a bigger cake. We're going to it reminds me of that song that was popular when I was in college, you know, the cats in the cradle and the silver spoon, and, you know, we're going to get together. Well, we'll get together, son. You know, can't get together with you right now, but we're going to get together. We're going to have a big time then. And, you know, the guy at the end realizes that, you know, I said, I'm going to be just like you, Dad. And at the end, he realized, you know, that oh my gosh, I'm just like my dad. You know, I've got all the stuff I can't get together with your dad, and you know, and so it's the idea that they, you know, that we're too busy. You know, too busy. Well, the changing view is that we're saving and saying we're not consuming. We're just building this bigger cake, but nobody consumes it. Nobody dare touch this cake. Well, that's nonsense. That is just sheer nonsense. That indeed, I mean, by the way, you can imagine the kind of people that it would appeal to. All right? It would definitely appeal to the intellectuals of Great Britain and the United States and the academic people. It's still, you know, I'm sure, I mean, it would still appeal to them, this kind of stuff. But look what happens in Great Britain. For that matter, the United States, standards of living go up. You know, why is it that they were so full of hope at the turn of the 20th century? Because they could see what was happening. I mean, the world was changing. The world in 1900, think of the world in 1900 versus the world in 1800. You know, 1800, my gosh, the Romans had higher standard living than what you saw in most places in Europe in 1800. 1900, people are, you know, people want to get in the middle class. They want, and they have a way to do it, and they're saving and investing and working. And this is just, Keynes just looks at this as, you know, nonsense. So he writes it sarcastically, but it's not true. And when he talks about this cake, it's just nonsense. All right. I want to do a little deconstructing of this paradox of thrift. Okay. And I don't have the year. I wrote a piece years ago for the Mises page called Fable of the Krugman. And, you know, I liken this stuff to Mandeville's Fable of the Bees. Well, Krugman himself has actually said that, hey, we got to have a situation in which virtues are seen as vices and vices seen as virtues. In other words, don't save, you got to spend. Don't, you know, they really say, oh my gosh, look at this disaster. That we're in a paradox of thrift right now. And blame the Chinese. Say, we had all these savings from China. That's what did it. And but what happens if the economy goes down? Hey, start spending again, right? Because the idea is that if people save instead of spend, the economy's going to get worse and worse. Now, I think we need to ask ourselves something. You know, and Tom, boy, I tell you, Tom Wood really done a good job on this. And asking, well, what about the Depression of 1921? Well, it was the Panic of 1921. And it was right after the war. There were adjustments to be made. Warren G. Harding was president, and he believed that government really shouldn't do anything to stop it. And so what happens? We come out of it. We come out of that pretty quickly. And so Keynes is arguing that, you know, if you start saving, if the government doesn't start spending, what's going to happen? The economy's going to continue to spiral downward until you get to this really bad equilibrium. And I was doing some research last night and coming into some of the people, I think it was Sismondi, that basically said the same thing. Keynes, boy, look at this terrible thing we're going to have. And people should look around because it hadn't happened. That the governments were not intervening, and that the economies did not spiral downward, right? And so the idea, again, paradox of thrift. Okay, it's okay if some people save, but if everybody saves, man, that's going to just have a disastrous effect. Well, Lewis points out, look, guys, there is no paradox of thrift. All right. Downturns aren't caused by excessive savings. They're caused by malinvestment. Okay. The other thing is that the purpose of savings is to be able to consume in the future. We do not save for the sake of saving. We save for the sake of consumption. I mean, people, oh, what about the miser? Well, there are some misers out there, but that's irrelevant because even their savings are going to be used for something. Even if these guys aren't going to spend, I mean, they're fine. Then they'll be financing somebody else's capital and somebody else's higher standard of living. And second, that here's the point, okay? The boom itself is wasteful, okay? After malinvestments are exposed, resources have to be directed to higher valued uses as determined by the, you know, the consumers. Now, you've got to, in order to be able to do that, you've got to have capital to be able to do it. And that's, it's got to come from saving. I want to think about this, okay? As opposed, because Keynes would have argued, no, government just provides easy money. We don't have to go through this. But think about this. Resources are real things. Factors of production are real things. And an economy is a very complex web of factors being directed to different uses to satisfy consumer desires and needs. And how do we do this? What is the mechanism that we use to bring this system into balance, to find what is needed, how we're going to do it, what kind of capital mix are we going, labor mix are we going to have, and all and the like? These are real things. Okay, the idea of pumping easy money into the system does not really get at the heart of what's going on, because it's a denial of malinvestments. But yet, the idea of, okay, should the government intervene to keep the dot-com boom going? In other words, should we continue to have all these companies start that we all know they're going to go out of business, and just artificially force up stock prices? The idea is some of us will get rich, or, you know, if we're clever enough. I mean, think about what this means, okay? That you really want to, you know, that's why I want to deconstruct it, because the paradox of thrift is a really bad idea. It's a bad thing, but the thing is, it's intuitive, isn't it? Oh, yeah, people start saving, we don't spend. Well, it's in that interim period. If you have the entrepreneurs, you're looking and saying, okay, where should these resources go? Where should these factors go? All right, how am I going to pay for it? Okay, and that's where the capital comes in from people who are saving. All right. Now, for a conclusion, 6:58. Yeah, I better conclude. All right, really quickly. All right, the Keynesian doctrines, again, they took hold, okay? World comes out of a world war. Things are wrecked. There's cynicism. And not surprisingly, things go into depression and following the really unsoundness of monetary policies and stuff during the 1920s. Of course, everybody blames capitalism, especially the intellectuals, because they say, put us in charge. And again, Keynes steps into this political intellectual vacuum, okay, exploits a crisis, and I think that's what I like what Rothbard says. I'm going to close with it, that Keynes was much more than a Keynesian. Above all, he was an extraordinarily pernicious and malignant figure, a charming but power-driven status Machiavelli, who embodied some of the most malevolent trends and institutions of the 20th century. It's not a compliment. All right. Okay. Do we have any questions beyond that? I'm looking. I really appreciate your taking care of so many. Great job. I really, really appreciate it. Does anybody have any questions? Well, hold on just for a couple minutes before signing off. But I hope that hope this has been a worthwhile evening. We will get together again a week from tonight. We'll be just back from the holidays, and next week, I want to continue. There are some things I want to look at. We'll look at some more of Keynes and also I would spend a little bit of time looking at Keynes and gold as well. He hated gold, all right, and we want to spend some time on that and his whole view of money. So we're gonna be doing a lot of work next week. All right, again, any questions? It's one of these speak now or forever hold your peace. But I do thank all of you for showing up. I wish all of you a very happy holiday this week. I hope that you're able to be with the people you want to be with and that you'll have a good time. All right, and your travels will be safe. I think tomorrow I'm going to have to drive through some snow and ice, I'm afraid, so I'm not real looking forward to that. But just want to encourage all of you and thank you again for showing up. So, all right, I'm going to go ahead and sign out. You guys take care. Thank you so much.